This is Talk of the Nation. Neil Conan is away. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington. In the past 6 weeks, there have been two high-profile stories surrounding end-of-life decisions. One is the story of Indiana Governor Frank O'Bannon, who suffered a severe stroke last month while attending a conference in Chicago. He spent 5 days in the hospital unconscious. Doctors said his prognosis was very poor, but they treated him with high blood pressure medication. Governor O'Bannon had written instructions about how he wanted to be treated in the event of a catastrophic illness or fatal injury. Based on those instructions, the O'Bannon family stopped the medication from being administered. Governor O'Bannon died less than half an hour later. The second story involves Terry Schiavo, the 39-year-old Florida woman whose feeding tube was removed yesterday by court order. This follows a nasty, lengthy battle between her husband and her parents. Terry Schiavo has been in a vegetative state for 13 years, ever since her heart temporarily stopped at the age of 26, leaving her severely brain damaged. Mrs. Schiavo did not have a living will. She did not leave any written instructions about end-of-life treatment. Her husband says she told him that she would choose death over being in a vegetative state. Her parents say their daughter wanted to live, and that even if she did not, life is worth holding on to under any circumstances. At the center of the Schiavo fight is the conversation many of us never have until it's too late. Some of us have living wills. Others advance directives. Some of us have confided in our partners, our parents, or our children. Some of us haven't said or written anything at all. But if we don't speak up, or if our expressed wishes are not that clear, who decides? What to talk about, what to say, and who to say it to, all without wincing? Have you written a living will or an advance directive? Have you talked to your family or your doctor about what you want done and what you don't want done in your last days? Call us with your questions and your stories. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. With us here in Studio 3A is Ronnie Roa. She's a lawyer and an associate editor at Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Thanks so much for joining us, Ronnie.
My pleasure. Very nice to be with you.
Let's start with terminology. Let's start there, because there's a lot of words and phrases here that a lot of people just, they have no idea what this means. What's an advance directive?
Okay, that's a very good place to start, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. An advance directive is a phrase that covers two basic kinds of documents. One is a living will. The living will is a document where you state your wishes for how the type of treatment you wish not to have if you become unable to state your wishes, and what you wish to have. And what that means is basically that you can say, yes, I would like every single thing that you can do for me, if you think it's going to even be remotely helpful. The thing that people don't understand about living wills is that they really only come into play if you have been declared terminally ill. Now, first of all, let's back up for one sec. If you have an advance directive of any kind, as long as you are able to make your wishes clear yourself, no one else makes those decisions for you. So if you can talk and say, no, don't do it, or you can shake your head, no, don't do it, they won't do it. But if you cannot, that's when any advance directive comes into play. Now, the living will comes into play only if you are declared terminally ill. Typically, that these things are all sort of covered by state law, so they vary. But generally, if you are determined to have less than 6 months to live, then if you become unable to make your decisions, the living will come into play. That's the first type of advance directive. The second type is the durable power of attorney for health care. Now, a lot of lawyers, in fact, most lawyers these days, I would say, would consider a durable power of attorney for health care as a basic part of that estate planning that we should all be doing anyway, will and things like that. And a durable power of attorney is the document that lets you name someone you trust and who understands you and your wishes to make decisions for you if you can't do it. Now, medical decisions, this is. The thing that's different about a living will and a durable power of attorney is that under a durable power, the agent, they could have other names, proxy, surrogate, a variety of different things in different states, but basically they are the one you say can make your decisions for you. If you become incapacitated, unconscious because of a car accident, and can't make decisions for yourself, then your agent, whether you're terminal or not, your agent can make those decisions. So the two documents are the basic ones that would come under advance directives. Now, just to complicate things a little bit further, in many states, one document that has become known as an advance directive will incorporate both of those things. So you may be able to cover all of those decisions with one document, naming someone and saying what you wish to happen at the end of your life.
Do people have these? Are they getting them?
Well, I wish I could say that more people are getting them than not, but since more than half of us don't even have wills, I think it is unlikely, though I don't actually have, I'll be honest, I don't have statistics, but my impulse is to say, since more than half of us don't have wills, probably a huge number of us have never confronted these kinds of issues.
Who decides? When we don't have any kind of advance directive?
Oh, okay. Well, when we don't have any kind of advance directive, it gets kind of tricky because there's federal law and state law. Under federal law, you are allowed, you have the right to make your own determinations as to care or lack of, or refusal of care. Now, if you have made that known to someone orally, and that person can convince whomever that, you know, it's your spouse or your parents or whomever it happens to be, then that would be evidence toward what you wanted. The best thing is to have it in writing, of course. If it gets ugly, which it did in that case in Florida, then a court can be involved, and they're going to look at the evidence of what, if there is any, of what you wished. That's what guides it. And if there is no evidence, then it becomes much harder and much uglier to try and settle. So there can be long, drawn-out battles. So if you have any feelings about this at all, you really, which young people maybe don't, but as you get a little older, you start thinking about these things more, you should probably take time to discuss them with someone and get it in writing. Because if you don't do it, you can open yourselves up to horrible situations. Now, I will say, Corva, that one of the things that people don't realize is most cases never get ugly. Most cases never get ugly at all because family and doctors agree on what's going to happen. If they don't know your wishes, they still are going to make a decision that everyone can live with, within their conscience, within medical ethics of the hospital and the doctor's own beliefs. So many of these cases, we never hear about most of them. It's unfortunately the few that make us aware of how tricky it can become.
Do you need an attorney to help you?
Well, not really. You can, of course, have that done. As I say, many attorneys now are doing this type of planning more as part of regular estate planning. So if you do get a will and discuss these things, it's going to come up, I think, in most cases now. I think it should, personally. But there are forms. Sometimes hospitals have forms. Your doctor may have a form. But the key thing is, if you're going to go to the trouble of doing it, first of all, you have to think about it a great deal. You have to decide what kinds of issues really are important to you. Do you want transfusions? Do you not? Do you want CPR? Do you want to be resuscitated if your heart stops, if you are terminally ill? We're talking here about such things as, you know, would be in a living will. Or do you want comfort care? Do you want the types of things that would make you comfortable even if it's not going to be super heroic? Issues that we don't really take apart for ourselves. But once you do that, getting it in writing also means executing it the way your state wants you to. And sometimes, in most cases, that would be in front of witnesses so that they can then say, you know, yes, this person had the mental capacity. He or she understood what she was doing, understood the meaning of it, and sometimes even notarized. That makes it a little better. So you don't have to have a lawyer to do that, but it's important to pay attention to instructions that your state might have, they may be printed on the form for your state.
We turn to Dr. Wyman, who's calling us from Richmond, Virginia. Good afternoon, Dr. Wyman.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Good. Thank you for raising an extremely important area. I'm a critical care physician, and as such have the privilege, or in some cases some might consider the burden, of dealing with end-of-life issues. And I think that what I believe is that it's extraordinarily important for the physicians to take responsibility for helping the family to navigate through a decision that is fraught with incredible emotion. And I think it's extraordinarily unfair for us as caregivers, physicians, nurses, whatever, to burden the family to make a decision which, as you've alluded to, has often not been discussed until the family have gathered by the bedside at a critically ill situation of whether or not they should resuscitate Aunt Mary or what have you. I think that if the patient is in a situation where the physicians have deemed that ongoing care is futile, and I would consider that scenario to be if the patient is clearly in the process of dying, if the patient is experiencing ongoing pain, and if the patient's humanity is being degraded, I think we really have to face the decision of whether or not it is appropriate to continue therapy. And in that situation, I would be very motivated to talk to the family and say, this is the scenario. We really have one option left, and that is of preserving your loved one's dignity, as opposed to going to the family and saying, I think the situation is critical. What do you want us to do? And whereas the two scenarios may sound just slightly different, there is a world of difference for the family when you speak to them later after the patient has ultimately succumbed. And I think that if we can take upon ourselves as caregivers the burden and the responsibility to say this is appropriate, and often it's not a question of coming up with an immediate decision, it's saying over a period of time, the patient over, let's observe the patient over 24 hours, if there's been no response to these drastic measures or to these accelerated measures, we may see that there is nothing further to do, and then we'll have to make a hard decision together. And I think that's a very important issue for me as a critical care physician.
Let me turn to Ronnie Roa, who is with us. Do many families face this chasm that Dr. Wyman is discussing?
I believe that many do. People are living longer and longer and becoming susceptible. More and more of the population is becoming susceptible to a lot of the frailties and vagaries and illnesses of old age. Of course, accidents can happen to young people as well, and they can become comatose in a vegetative state at any age, of course. But I think a lot of families are facing this, and I think the doctor made me think of a point that's really critical as far as I'm concerned with this, and that is, this is planning. If you are going to do planning and then work with the physician, understand what the physician is telling you your choices are or the results, this is planning that cannot be done in secret.
You have to
talk about it and let people know, and make sure your doctor understands your wishes as well.
We're talking about the different ways to let families and doctors know what you want done and what you don't want done when you reach the end of your life. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You may also send us email at totn@npr.org. I'm Korva Coleman. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington. We're discussing how families can talk about the often uncomfortable subject of death and the often complicated legal, emotional, and medical issues surrounding death. My guest is Ronnie Roa, a lawyer and associate editor at Kiplinger's Personal Finance. I would also like to welcome Dr. Joseph Finns. He works with patients and families who are grappling with these very issues. Dr. Finns is chief of medical ethics at Weill Cornell Medical College and a practicing internist. He's with us from the studios of the BBC in New York. Welcome, Dr. Finns.
Thanks for having me.
You've been able to listen in on our conversation so far. As you're a doctor, what do you find when you're in the hospital talking with families and treating seriously ill patients? What is the greatest issue that you see regarding coping with the imminence of death?
Well, I think one of the things that we talk about patient self-determination is we fail to recognize the burden that's imposed on surrogates or family members who are often confronted with very difficult choices, not knowing what the patient would have wanted. It's not just about patient self-determination. It's about relieving the burden on loved ones and having the conversation. It's what a responsible family member does for people who they really care about. So I think that these are very challenging cases, and none of us are really immune. I think the doctor who was on earlier summed it up very well. And your other guest also commented, young people are not immune from this. And indeed, all the major cases that have led to the right to die, the Quinlan case, the Cruzan case, the Schiavo case that we now are discussing involve young women, interestingly enough. And in the Cruzan case, Sandra Day O'Connor herself suggested, wouldn't it be a good idea in her decision to have some sort of advance directive so we could avoid these kinds of difficult scenarios?
How do people start this conversation? How do they talk about it in the first place?
Right. Well, I agree with the earlier caller that doctors do have a role, and I bring it up with my patients and try to get them to talk about it. There have been studies that show that if the patients think it was important enough, the doctor would bring it up. Doctors themselves are as death phobic as the rest of society, so physicians and nurses and other practitioners have to get involved. I often bring it up in the context of prevention. We tell people not to smoke, to wear seatbelts, to eat responsibly, and this is also a kind of a preventative measure. I often reassure them, saying this does not mean that we're expecting anything catastrophic to happen to you. I often will say I myself have an advance directive to reassure them. And most of the time, overwhelmingly, they're grateful to have this opportunity, to have this sanctioned space to talk about these issues.
We're joined by Stephen from Kalamazoo, Michigan. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Stephen.
Thanks very much, Korva. I'd like to relate a story to you.
Please.
My father, who was in his middle 80s, wore a pacemaker defibrillator, had had a number of strokes and heart attacks, knew he was dying. He was in the hospital. They had him. He had signed a do not resuscitate, no extraordinary measures document. My sister is a registered nurse. She was there with my mother. They had him on a resuscitator. He wanted off the resuscitator. He knew he was dying. He said, I want to die in my own home. Just please let me go home. The doctor actually refused to take him off the resuscitator, only until my father literally ripped the thing out of his mouth. And my sister talked the doctor into finally releasing him. So he went home. When he got home, got his own bed, and my sister sat there and held his hand and said, you know, it's okay, Dad, you can let go now, and he died, which is all he wanted to do, just die in his own house.
Ronnie, is this something that can't be avoided no matter what we say, no matter what we write, no matter what we inform people? I mean, Stephen's got a very compelling case.
Yes, it's really a very sad situation when that happens. You know, it gets very, very tricky because, yes, the medical community and the doctor can talk about this as well, but the medical community overall, generally, under law, is bound to honor your wishes if you've expressed them. You have the right to refuse treatment, but there are conditions and circumstances under which a physician or an ethics committee in a hospital can say, well, that isn't what we do. That isn't how we don't feel that way at this point for these reasons of conscience, reasons of ethics. And that does happen, and that's not wrong. It just, you cannot guarantee. But I think it goes back to, in part, now perhaps this fellow's father had discussed all of these issues and had all of this hashed out with his physician in the first place, before any of this catastrophic decline occurred, that's probably one of the best things you can do, because you'll know at what point your physician and the hospital that he or she practices in will make these kinds of decisions that may not be in concert with yours.
Stephen, had your father had that type of conversation?
Well, he hadn't had the conversation. However, he had signed all the required documents that you know, he did not want any extraordinary measures. And once again, my sister is a registered nurse, and she, you know, she had assured him that that would happen for him.
Right. It's it's very unfortunate, I think, when the expectation is one thing and the practice is another. But I do think that in his situation...
To be fair, I just want to say that, you know, about 75 to 80% of deaths in American hospitals today are deaths where there is a decision not to resuscitate.
Right.
We remember the extreme cases, but they're not necessarily reflective of practice. But I would just say to Stephen and for others like him who may encounter this situation, there are resources in hospitals, the patient ombudsman, a patient representative, the hospital ethics committee, that can help to level the playing field so that there's a kind of parity. Your family, unfortunately, was at its very most vulnerable moment, and you needed allies to help you, in effect, exercise your father's prerogative, his legal prerogative and his ethical choice to make this decision. Mm-hmm. So there are resources in the hospital, and patients and families have to be proactive in identifying them if they're in this kind of situation.
I have an email here from Brad in Portland, Oregon, who writes, "I am gay, and I would like to have a living will and a medical durable power of attorney drawn up to have my partner make medical decisions when I am unable to." Now, he writes, "I've heard that hospitals and doctors will often ignore these documents if a person is not legally married, and obviously gay couples cannot marry. So is this true, and what advice would you give, Brad?"
Well, I honestly don't. That issue, I hate to say it, has not come up for me. I haven't really thought about or focused on that in my research, but I think that in many cases, this again is an issue for communication, of knowing in advance, because the person or group that might object to the partner making these decisions may well be the family of the person who is in extremis, and so you'd want to know that they were on board as well. If they are not,
can I just add that under New York law, we actually recommend this to couples who have significant others or close friends who may not be close to their biological family. The healthcare proxy, the durable power of attorney, would have precedence over family members and other natural surrogates, and we recognize that prerogative. The whole fundamental thing here is that this individual has chosen his healthcare proxy to be his representative. Of the 6 billion people on the planet, that's the person he wants to make the decision. I think it's advisable that he speak with other members in his family to let them know that this is his choice. But even if they didn't know, it would still be a legitimate and legally binding choice in our jurisdiction in New York State.
So I think, it points out that there may well be differences among the states, and it's something they should look into and find out for sure about what the precedents would be. I think many times people choose unrelated individuals to be their proxy, and they don't necessarily even have to be as significant as a significant other. It is not forbidden, and you have made your wishes known. The issue then becomes whether the family will get in the act of
but it
not
sounds like it would
it.
Be a very, very wise thing for gay and lesbian couples to each have both a living will and advance directive, and to tell as many people as
can
possible.
Can I speak to that, having a living will and a healthcare proxy or agency? Mm-hmm. Sometimes that creates confusion when there's contradiction in the instructions in the living will, which are often generic. I don't want extraordinary measures. They can be vague, and what's extraordinary to you may not be extraordinary to the person who's reading it. I am much more favorably disposed to actually choosing someone, have the conversation beforehand, give him or her information that they would need about contingencies and your values and your beliefs, how long you would want to tolerate treatment, and when you might want to stop it. The living will is really a very imprecise document, and it itself is open to the kind of interpretation that can bottleneck your intentions, your fundamental intentions about not wanting certain kinds of treatment.
Let's jump to Laura in Portland, Oregon. Laura, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. My question is, I have no close friends except one, and she's not even in the same city I'm in, and I have no relatives except quite elderly relatives, and I do not want to burden my friend because she has more problems than she can deal with now. And as I'm quite ill, I need to make one of these advance directives, but I don't know who to appoint as my representative.
What should Laura do? Ronnie?
Well, in most states, it's my understanding that you cannot name your doctor. You cannot, as your agent, it has to be someone, and no one who can, unless it's a family member who even works at an institution that you might be involved with as a hospital or hospice or whatever. It's a tough situation. I am not really sure. There are people for whom an advance directive doesn't work very well because of that. I agree with the doctor who's in his saying that a durable power or naming an agent is a more useful, more beneficial way to go overall, because then you do have the human interaction during your life, hopefully, if you've done it well.
Can I just interject here? I mean, I would do two things. I would speak to your friend and find out whether it really is a burden. From research that we've done on the patient-proxy relationship, patients are often very hesitant to call upon friends and loved ones for this responsibility. But those individuals are often more willing than you might think. And secondly, if she's unable to do it for you, I would complete in this case a living will, and I would also speak with your doctor and have him document in his medical record what your wishes are, so that can satisfy in a clear and convincing way what your intentions were, and his medical notes will become a kind of advance directive that can provide some protection from unwanted therapy later on.
Okay, we're going to jump to Kim in Cleveland, Ohio. Welcome to Talk of the Nation, Kim.
Yes. My father recently passed away. It was 2 months ago, and he was a physician, and we had to make the decision as a family as to whether to stop life support. We checked with his attorney, and he said that he did not have a living will and was specifically asked if he wanted one. He said no, and the attorney said that was not all that uncommon for doctors to deny a living will, which surprised me immensely, but when we had to make the decision, he had a neurologist, a cardiologist, a pulmonologist. There were a million different doctors involved in his care, and all of them were telling us different things. One would say he'd never make it. One say he had a chance. One said they'd need to do this test. So it was very hard to make the decision with so many conflicting things being told to us.
What do you do in such a situation? Dr. Finn?
Well, I think, you know, one of the most important things that seems to guide the decision-making is the sense of prognosis and what is the outcome. So I would really try to get a better sense of what the likely outcome would be, and then reflect back on what the patient's values were and whether that is the kind of chance that the individual would want to take. Would he want to assume the burdens of the care against the potential benefits? And so we've actually created an advanced directive booklet for patients and families that have different disease scenarios, different amounts of information that can train people to have these conversations to look at some of the contingencies. And again, we deliberately wrote some of the cases with incomplete information because that is often what happens. Mm-hmm. And if people are interested, they can go to the Weill Cornell Med School website in the Department of Public Health and get information there.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I have another email here from Josh Torres, who writes, is there a place on the net to download forms for a living will, either for free or for a minimal fee? Ronnie?
Well, there is a vast amount of information and availability of forms on the web. For example, to go through some of the scenarios that Dr. Finns was talking about, the American Bar Association's Committee on Legal Problems of the Elderly, though of course these issues would apply to other than elderly, at aba.net/elderly, you will find their kit. They have a toolkit for people to discuss, think about, and work through these decisions. And they're also, and in other places on the net, if you put in advance directives, you'll find places where you can download different sites. I want to say Oh, all of a sudden I've lost the name of an organization, Care, Concern for Dying, Concern for Dying?
No, it's now PFC, Partnership for Caring.
That's right. I knew I had that. I was thinking of the old name. They have excellent information as well.
Right.
We're joined by Karuna in Cotati, California.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I am just thrilled that you're doing this show because I see one of the most important pieces here, in addition to the legal documents and the drawbacks or the cracks that might come with that, is the conversation, is having the conversation, at least starting the conversation, and having it more than once, especially if you're a young person, if you're in your 40s or 50s, and you start to talk about this with your spouse or your partner or your family. Once you start the conversation, then as things come up in life that make you think about, well, gosh, maybe I wouldn't want this, or maybe I would want this, those conversations are going to be much easier. I'm the founder of an organization called A Gift for Life, and I do workshops to help people start these conversations. And one of the things that I give to them that I want to offer here is a journal. And that is to start writing down, in addition to the legal documents, also start writing down the other kinds of things that you're going to want towards the end of life. If you have a particular spiritual practice that you want to make sure you include certain people, if you want candles in the room, if you don't want candles, if there's certain people you want at your funeral, if there's a song, I mean, everything. In addition to the medical things, too, because I think if we can broaden the conversation, it will make those conversations that much easier. And that is going to be the key to making sure the wishes are fulfilled, in addition to any form that you can fill out.
Dr. Finns, do you find that people don't talk as much as they should? They don't talk about the things, even about the things that Karuna is mentioning here. It's scary to talk about this.
It is scary, but in all the conversations that I've been party to with patients and families, after the conversation has been had, there's often a big sigh of relief that it's out there on the table, and it's in itself, it's a kind of a palliative, just a discussion. But a lot of things, times people talk about what they don't want, and I think it's very important, as the caller suggested, to talk about the kinds of things you do want. You know, medical ethics in the last 25, 30 years has been about the right to be left alone. But it's also the right to get good palliative care, pain and symptom management, being placed in a hospice is what you want, going home to die. So we have to talk not about only what we don't want, but the things that we really cherish and do want at the end of our days.
Dr. Joseph Finns is Chief of Medical Ethics at Weill Cornell Medical College. He joined us from the studios of the BBC in New York City. Dr. Finns, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'd like to let you know that when we come back from a short break, the moral complexity of making and carrying out end-of-life decisions will be our topic. I'm Corva Coleman. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today, we're discussing the ethical questions surrounding end-of-life medical decisions. Join our conversation. Has your family sat down and talked about end-of-life issues, and how did that conversation go? Call us at 800-989-TALK. Our guest is Ronnie Roa, a lawyer and associate editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Also joining us now on the phone from Castle Green, Indiana, is Professor David Orentlicker. He's a law professor and faculty member at the Center for Bioethics at Indiana University. He's also the author of Matters of Life and Death, Making Moral Theory Work in Medical Ethics and the Law. Professor Orentlicker, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Professor Orentlicker, the subtitle of your book is quite intriguing, Making Moral Theory Work in Medical Ethics and the Law, and how it actually works in practice. How does that work? Is it effective?
Well, it's very hard to make the transition from theory to practice. We can say in the classroom what the rules should be, but when it's time to apply them, take the requirement that when you're speaking for a family member with an end-of-life decision, you put yourself in their shoes. Well, it's very hard to do that. We try to see things through other people's eyes, but we can only see them through our own eyes, and what you see are family members and physicians talking more about what they would want rather than what the patient would want, even though they think they're talking about what the patient would want. The other problem we have is people bring their own interests to the table, and I can remember an example with my family where one of my relatives was dying of breast cancer and had left very clear instructions, filled out one of the more precise forms, the medical directive form, indicating what her wishes were, and it was pretty clear, I thought, what her wishes were at the end, but her husband wanted more care and agreed to more care than I think she would have wanted. I think part of it was hard for him to let go, and he had his desire to still have her alive that entered the equation, and I think the fact that people bring their own interests as well as it's hard to see through other people's eyes, I think that makes it hard to follow out the ethical principles we set down.
Is it possible to have this conversation go the other way? That is it ever happen or does it ever happen where someone wants or wishes more care and their agent or proxy actually ensures that they receive less?
Oh, that can be a real problem. In fact, the reality is when I do ethics consults now, the cases I see are the reverse of what we normally think of. What we see now are what we call the futility cases, where doctors may say it doesn't make sense to provide this treatment, and the family or the patient may be saying, I actually want this treatment. And so you get in disagreements where the family has to fight or the patient would have to fight for more treatment. And sometimes you see this between the doctors and the patient, sometimes the family and the patient. We had a case where a patient had been living by herself and suffered a minor stroke, and there were complications. But it seemed like the person could recover with several months of care, but was currently unable to speak, and the family was saying, stop. We don't want to prolong death. Well, to a lot of us, it looked like further care would prolong life rather than prolong death. But in their view, and it's hard, and eventually they prevailed because they spoke unanimously as a family, but we had to wonder whether they were doing it because they understood the parents' wishes better than we did, or because they had their own concerns at stake. You know, the parent would now become a burden as they were, in their view, they would have to care for somebody who has previously lived independently.
What about someone perhaps who might be elderly? Is it possible that those who are elderly who enter facilities, nursing care homes, hospitals for a short period of time are pressured perhaps to sign some type of advance directive that they either A, don't understand, or B, really don't endorse, but just have to get the paperwork out of the way?
Well, I think what may happen is when you start raising these kinds of issues, you tend to raise them selectively. You don't raise them with every person. And when you do bring them up with some people, you're sending a signal that you think this is probably a wise thing for them to do. Why else would you be bringing it up and suggesting that they consider it? And when you get that kind of a signal from a healthcare provider, it can be very influential. And I think we have to worry about that.
I'd like to bring Ronnie Roa back into the conversation. As an attorney, what do you advise people? Let's take this case that Professor Orentlicker is talking about. a lot of us, I think, when we sit down to actually have a living will or an advance directive written up, think about using these because we think we've been in a terrible accident, we're going to be in a persistent vegetative state, we're not going to get better, we don't want to hang on like that until something finally at some point ends our life. We never think about this short-term stuff.
Well, that's where the durable power of attorney... Well, first of all, I think that signing anything that is not very specific these days is not a good idea. There are excellent forms that address very great degree of nuance in these things, first of all. Second of all, the durable power gives you an agent who's going to be speaking on your behalf. Now, if you do not talk with the agent, if you don't have a good form that explains how you really feel about all of these things, then you're not really doing yourself any good.
Let me add a couple more complexities that are interesting. There was a study that where they asked people who were on chronic dialysis, so, you know, were likely to have decisions made for them and were in a chronic situation where they were familiar with what was going on, and they asked them, if you filled out your wishes, you made your wishes known, would you want them followed if your family and doctors felt that it was in your best interest not to follow them? And it turned out about a third of the patients said, follow my wishes exactly as I've laid them out, and another third said, well, if you think that in your view of my best interest, you ought not to follow my wishes, don't do that. Another thing that I think is important is I agree absolutely, having conversations with family members, making your wishes known as best you can is so important. The other thing to take into account and to consider is a lot of studies indicate that maybe the best predictor of treatment at the end of life is not what the patient wants or says, but what the doctor thinks is best for the patient, that getting back to it, we can see through our own eyes. And a thing to take into account is to understand what your doctor's views are about end-of-life decisions and try to match up with a doctor who shares your perspectives, just as patients often do that who are undergoing cancer treatment. We know there are aggressive cancer centers and more conservative cancer centers, and patients often take that into account in picking their doctor.
In fact, I would agree with that. The knowing what your doctor thinks. I mean, what we're talking about here, we're talking to the people who have yet to be in a situation where any of these things would apply. So we're talking to young people who are perfectly healthy, middle-aged, older people who are fine and have not yet come to this. But talking about it in advance lets you explore with your physician what he or she believes to be their philosophy. What is their philosophy of end-of-life decisions? And that's, again, where communication on all levels is critical to this.
I want to jump back to something we mentioned earlier. We received an email from a friend, Jim Dobson, who let us know that the correct email address, web address that we referenced earlier this hour, is actually www.abanet.org. Whatever else it was, ignore that previous one. It's www.abanet.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'd like to welcome Mike from Livonia, Michigan. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
How are you?
I'm great. Your question?
Well, I just had a comment. I am a geriatric social worker and care manager in the Detroit area. And I did not have an opportunity to listen to the show in its entirety, but I would like to make the comment about how necessary and valuable your listeners would probably benefit from using a social worker with my kind of experience and background in helping them to make these kind of decisions. Doctors and attorneys can also benefit from having a geriatric social worker involved with those particular problems.
Mike, how does one find a geriatric social worker?
Well, usually you should probably consult with an elder care attorney or your doctor.
Are you guys in the Yellow Pages?
You know, I don't believe there are very many of them in the Yellow Pages, probably because of the expense.
Okay.
But you could find one through a local area agency on aging, you could find one through a home health care company, typically through a city senior assistance program. They usually have resources for those type of social workers, but they're highly specialized. I myself have over 18 years experience practicing in this area, but I fully support everything I've heard today from the professionals making comments. I have run into situations myself where my clients and patients have not done an advance directive or a living will. And in certain circumstances, I have found family members who have not made good choices for them.
I'd like to throw this back to Professor Orentlicker. Have you worked with geriatric social workers, Professor? I'm sorry, social workers who practice in the area of geriatrics, I should say.
You know, I haven't, but I think the caller does make a good point that it's not only the doctor-patient or the doctor-lawyer. There are other health professionals who can become involved and often may have more time, especially in a setting of managed care where doctors might have 5 or 10 minutes per patient, working with other health professionals who can spend the time to have the dialogue and the discussion and then make it more feasible for the patient to document their wishes. That's a very good idea.
I'd like to throw this back to Ronnie Roa. Have you worked with social workers? And I mean, I think Mike makes a good point. You should contact an attorney, but I don't know that many people even have attorneys, since at the very beginning of this show you said a lot of us don't even fill out wills, but I can find in my white pages, my yellow pages, the Office on Aging.
That's right. And no, I have not. Over time, I have talked with people in that field in my work, but I have not worked with any in a situation like those we're talking about. I think that, though, that it's excellent to look for the people who, you know, the local area agency on aging, look for the people who are used to dealing with the elderly. They can be helpful to people who are not elderly as well, though their specialty, of course, is geriatrics, perhaps. If you have issues that you want to discuss and are trying to figure out how to bring them up with your family, you might get some really good advice that way.
Professor Orentlicker, this all boils down to choice, and I guess what I'm thinking is that we may go through all the paperwork, we may have the conversations, we may be very explicit about what we want, and yet at the very end of it all, there's still a level of complexity, it seems, that one just can't plan for.
That's exactly right. One study, for example, found, I think, that half the advance directives that patients had filled out never were used. You know, they might have been in the medical chart even, but actually didn't, when the decision had to be made, were overlooked. And then you get into problems where people, there's some ambiguity in what they say, or people view it differently, or even if you say, I'm not interested in ventilation. My spouse lingered on a ventilator, and I don't want that. And then you have a situation where the person, I mentioned the case where the person had a stroke, and the family wanted to take the patient off the ventilator. And in the view of the healthcare providers, the person's opposition to ventilator was really tied to chronic ventilation for months, and this is only going to be for a week or so. And that's probably not what the person meant. And the family said, no, even for a week or two, that would be too much. And it really is hard to sort these things out when the person can't, people can't speak for themselves.
David Orentlicker is a law professor at the Center for Bioethics at Indiana University. His book is called Matters of Life and Death. He spoke with us on the phone from Greencastle, Indiana. Ronnie Roa is a lawyer and associate editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance. She joined us here in Studio 3A. Thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
I'm Corva Coleman in Washington for NPR News.